Is the United States less a democracy than a plutocracy now, governed by the wealthy elite? Have we become a nation by the rich and for the rich? Or do capital gains fuel economic growth, creating jobs and bolstering business, increasing social mobility for all? In this hour of midday, a hard look at the income inequality that has drawn public denunciations from Pope Francis and President Obama, and which stands at the center of arguments that the U.S. has been transformed into a plutocracy. Historian Ronald Formosano argues that point in the hour ahead, and we'll hear a challenge to Formosano's view from Thea Brooke Knight, a financial regulation expert with the libertarian Cato Institute. Capitalism, Inequality, and Democracy on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour. Pope Francis in Washington today and this week made a lot of noise earlier this year when he tweeted, "Inequality is the root of social evil." The Pope also said, quote, "Once capital becomes an idol and guides people's decisions, once greed for money presides over the entire socioeconomic system, it ruins society, it condemns and enslaves men and women, it destroys human fraternity, it sets people against one another, and as we clearly see, it even puts at risk our common home," words of Pope Francis. Of course, for many Americans, market capitalism is our country's crowning achievement, making us the land of opportunity. But our first guest this hour would disagree with that. In a time of extreme income inequality, he says, quote, "Congress and a reactionary Supreme Court majority cater to a Hydra-headed plutocracy that enjoys a government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich." Words of Ronald Formosano, the William T. Bryan Chair of American History and Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Kentucky. His book, Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor, was just released from Johns Hopkins University Press here in Baltimore. So we'll spend this hour with Ronald Formosano talking about whether this country of ours has moved from democracy to plutocracy, ruled by the wealthy. Ronald Formosano, I want to welcome you to the Midday Show here on WYPR.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be with you.
Some people hear the phrase income inequality, or even the longer phrase extreme income inequality, or widening income gap, wealth gap in the United States. And they say, well, what do you propose to do about that? That's just the natural order of things. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer or stay the same. So what do you want to do about it? You hear this. This is the response to it from a lot of people.
Sure. First of all, there's nothing natural about it. The current inequality has been created by three decades of government policy, both in terms of action and inaction. And in my book, I make the argument that we've really reached a tipping point. We're not a pure plutocracy, but we are much less of a democracy than we were. Representative government has been functioning for basically three decades to have income flow upward, and it has been diminishing the middle class, literally. The middle class not only has less median income than it had years ago, it is also smaller than it was. And it's important to note that the middle class was regarded as the bedrock of American democracy. Back in the 1960s and 70s, when I was studying political science, all the political science talked about America's civic culture as a model for the world. And what was so great about it? A middle class, a strong middle class that was built from the 1930s to the 1950s, and that middle class is being diminished. So there's nothing natural about inequality. You know, Madison said that inequality was inevitable in famous Federalist Number 10. But he went on to really talk about the need to diminish it. And all the founding fathers used Europe as their reference point. And I make that point in my book. I discuss the founding fathers. And they looked at Europe as what they did not want the United States to be. Now, sure, they accepted slavery. They built it into the Constitution, although they never mentioned the word. They weren't eager to have women vote or people of color, and some of them were not excited about even having what they call the lower orders of white men voting. But when Alexis de Tocqueville visited this country in the 1830s, he said, "Everything in the United States, it all comes back to equality of condition." And that was essential for the Founding Fathers. They made exceptions to that, convenient, especially for slave owners. Mm-hmm. But over time, they expected the United States not to be Europe, not to have extremes of inequality.
I want to go to a contemporary example of something that our government produced and talk to you a little bit about it in the frame of this idea of whether we're, you know, a plutocracy in America. The Affordable Care Act, okay? Barack Obama is elected president. The Affordable Care Act is proposed by the Democrats in Congress to address a couple of things. One is the high cost of health insurance to all of us to compensate for those who are not insured, the some 50 million Americans who do not have insurance. And, you know, the Republicans lined up against that, and then since it's passed, they've tried some 50 times to repeal it. There's been, the case has gone to the Supreme Court where, the major parts of it were upheld. So that exists. I mean, that came out of that came out of our representative democracy. As tough as it was, it's there. It exists. More people have health insurance today than had it 7 or 8 years ago. So is that not evidence that we still have a representative democracy that serves all?
That's some evidence, yes. And in fact, I would add to what you just said. I'm sorry about this hoarseness in my voice. I would add to what you just said by saying that the Affordable Care Act even has a redistributive quality about it. And it has made for less income at the top and more income in the middle and the bottom. And it's also done a wonderful thing by insuring so many people that did not have health care. And again, I have to give President Obama some credit for chipping away at the inequality that exists. We're the only country, advanced country in the world, that doesn't have paid maternity leave. And he's suggested that we move in that direction. Paid sick leave. 40% of workers in this country don't have paid sick leave. He's moving in that direction. So, yeah, but I would argue that that our representative government, democracy has been undermined. Louis Brandeis, the great progressive Supreme Court justice, said it a long time ago. You can either have great concentration of wealth in this country or democracy. You cannot have both. And we really have reached a point where, just look at the education system. Americans are slowly realizing that Horatio Alger is dead. The education system is supposed to build a middle class. It's supposed to provide social mobility. But we have less mobility in this country than peer countries do. And the education system is failing. It's working great for the affluent. It's working great for the affluent. And wealthy people are putting enormous resources into making sure their kids get into elite private universities. They're also spending their money in ways to make sure that happens. I think while there's some palliative efforts going on to diversify the populations of our elite, both public and private universities, Sean Reardon at the Stanford University puts it very well in terms of describing what's going on in our education system, and that is no rich child left behind. So the education system isn't working to promote the kind of social mobility that Americans are accustomed to. And we've got $1 trillion in student debt. There's also the for-profits that are taking advantage of veterans and low-income people, and they've essentially turned into debt factories. And when the Obama administration tries to do something about it, Congress protects the for-profit colleges and universities. And so many studies have been done to show that these are essentially traps of debt. And in fact, William Bennett, back in the Reagan administration, his Secretary of Education, Republicans had a very different attitude toward for-profits back in the 1980s. He said they're nothing but ways to trap low-income people into debt.
Just to slip back to the Affordable Care Act, just to make one more point about it, and that is you say Congress preserves the for-profit schools. Congress also preserved the for-profit health insurance companies. You know, there are many people who say the better system would have been, and maybe someday we'll get there, a single-payer system, much like Medicare. So there, I just brought it up because there you have a capitalistic entity, capitalistic culture of health insurance in balance somewhat with the legislation that was passed by the representative democracy.
Well, ask yourself the question, why was single payer taken off the table right at the start?
It was dead on arrival, right? It wasn't even really considered.
It was dead on arrival, but Max Baucus, who was chairing the Senate Finance Committee, was receiving enormous amounts of money from the insurance industry. And then when the proposal to expand Medicare, lower the age for eligibility, who shot that down? Guy from Hartford, remember him?
Yep.
Senator from Hartford? There happens to be lots of insurance companies in Hartford. Mm-hmm. So those are examples of what I'm talking about. I said at the start, I think we've reached a tipping point toward plutocracy. We have thousands of lobbyists looking at the tax structure, looking at all kinds of ways in which they can enhance the profits of special interest groups, and I'm talking about businesses and corporations and bankers and Wall Street, and they get their way a heck of a lot of the time. I'll stop with that.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about wealth and inequality here before we go to our first break with Ronald Formisano. Thomas Piketty, the French economist, his big book from the last year, Capital in the 21st Century. I'm reducing this down to a simple argument. If the return on capital is greater than the economy's growth rate, then inequality will continue to increase. Basically, that's what he said. Because wealth grows faster than wages, then only the rich have much wealth to begin with. So they're already ahead of the game. The mention you made of the privileged kids in college, they are ahead of the game. There's an old economic saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. Not everybody has a boat these days, right?
Right?
I mean, that's the difference in the age that we're living in now, right? The growth rate of wealth, that the wealthy already have so much and it's growing so much faster than wages are for the middle class and lower middle classes.
Yeah, some people have very leaky boats, and some people have yachts, and there's a big difference between the two. Piketty, the French economist, it's a terrific book, by the way. He does emphasize, and not enough in my view, that politics is at the heart of it. He does revise the old idea that prosperity was inevitable to really simplify. Simon Kuznets' idea, who was the reigning authority on the matter of equality and inequality in the economics profession. And Piketty has taken that on and made the argument that you just summarized. However, he does say, ultimately, politics make a very big difference. And someone like the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who's written a very good book on the price of inequality, he argues, look, it's the politics, stupid. It really makes a difference. Now, what Piketty emphasizes above all is the extremity of CEO pay. That is, executives who walk away with incredible compensation packages, even if the performance of their company has been dismal, but they still walk away. And why is that? Because they basically get to set their own salaries. Who would not set their own salary if they had the opportunity to do so? And they're very cozy with their boards of directors. That's what Piketty emphasizes as the main driver of inequality. But it's so much more than that. It's so much more than that. It's a rigged tax system. It's predators on the poor. This is, you know, my book is similar to some very good books. I trot out the measures of inequality of wealth and income in the United States. More extreme. It has grown more extreme in the United States than any other of our peer countries except one. And you can trot that out. But then you've got to cast a much wider net. And you've got to look at predators on the poor. You've got to look at payday loan, auto title loans, stolen wages from workers, the way in which federal contractors are paying executives who have federal contractors who are making $800,000 a year, and they're stealing wages from workers, and so many of those workers are paying $12 an hour or less, and they are being compensated at the top with taxpayer money while they are paying peanuts to their workers. There's just so much of this, and maybe I'll be able to mention some more of it as we talk, as we have continue our conversation.
One thing, Ronald Formisano, before we go to the break, capital gains tax. We're going to talk about that in this hour. Our next guest will be joining us soon, Thea Brooke Knight from the Cato Institute. So capital gains tax, and in Maryland, in this state, just last year, 2014, yes, you know, a reduction in inheritance taxes paid in this state. And you look at that and you say, well, why is that happening? Because people just don't fundamentally believe. I won't speak for everybody in this country, but a lot of people are very skeptical about whether, you know, cuts in capital gains tax encourages people to invest, to create jobs. The 2012 presidential election, Obama against Romney, that argument was made. And was Mitt Romney really a job creator or a job reducer? Anyway, that class of folks who are actually in position to have to pay those taxes, the question is, what's going on there? Are they investing in this country? Are they creating jobs? Are they creating wealth? And if you look at the stats, it doesn't appear to be the case. They're creating wealth for themselves.
I would go further than talking about a plutocracy. And Piketty, whom we just discussed, forecasts a future, both in Europe and in the United States, where inherited wealth is going to really determine who runs governments. And we need to start using the word aristocracy, because an aristocracy of wealth is on the way to being created in this country. And it's not just the 15% that Warren Buffett says he pays, while everybody in his office, over 30 workers, are paying more, including his secretaries. That's what's trending us toward an aristocracy. I don't think we've reached a tipping point as I do in terms of plutocracy, but it's a danger. And the dynasties are essentially being created. So yeah, the 15%, that is a pillar of inequality. It is a pillar of plutocracy, really. And that's just something that when somebody, even like Warren Buffett, oh, by the way, and Buffett has said he doesn't know of anyone who, if they were taxed more on capital gains, would be discouraged to take entrepreneurial chances. And there have been studies done of that, too, by economists. So I think that answers your question.
Thank you, Ronald. We'll take a break here. Ronald Formisano, our guest, is the author of Plutocracy in America, a new book from Johns Hopkins University Press, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. If you'd like to join us, our phone number here in Baltimore is 410-662-8780. Toll-free, long-distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. You can also send an email with comments or questions that I'll read on the air at midday@wypr.org. When we get back, Thea Brooke Knight of the Cato Institute in Washington will be joining this conversation. You can, too. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Our guest in this hour is Ronald Formisano, who is a professor of history, historian, and professor emeritus of history at the University of Kentucky, author of an earlier book, The Tea Party, A Brief History, and For the People, American Populist Movements from the Revolution to the 1850s. His latest book from JHU Press is Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. Now I'd like to welcome to this discussion Thea Brooke Knight of the Cato Institute in Washington. Thea Brooke Knight is an attorney with expertise in finance and financial regulation. In fact, she's associate director of the Financial Regulation Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thea Brooke Knight, thank you very much for joining this conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
Income inequality. We're going to hear the Pope talk about it this week in Washington. He's already talked about it a lot, and certain to talk about it again. So when you hear that phrase and people present that as a problem, as Ronald Formisano does in this book, do you and colleagues at Cato see it as a problem, or do you look at it quizzically and wonder why people present this as a problem?
Well, I can speak only for myself and not for my colleagues, but I think that oftentimes we lump a lot of things into the concept of income inequality. When we hear the word equality, I think most of us associate something good with it. But what we actually, and we often think of equality as being equivalent to fairness, but actually they're quite different. So, equality means everything the same, whereas fairness often means that equality of opportunity. Income inequality talks about output, what are the outcomes, where do you wind up? Equality of opportunity means sort of where do you start from. Just to start with, I want to make sure that we're talking about the right things, because I think sometimes this all gets lumped into one general idea of fairness, when actually these are separate concepts.
Ron, you want to respond to that?
Well, I'd like to say a couple of things to... Is it Thea?
It's Thea, T-H-A-Y-A.
Thea
Brooke Knight. Yeah.
And she can call me Ron.
Thank you.
Her name, Thea, were you at the Cato Institute in 2012?
I wasn't.
Ah, too bad. Because I wanted to compliment the Cato Institute on preventing the Kochs from taking it over and becoming their mouthpiece. I think that was very admirable for the Institute to remain relatively independent. And the second thing is, my book, For the People, has a very favorable view of the Anti-Federalists. And I think if the Anti-Federalists looked at equality of opportunity and the way in which middling people are really not represented in our government, I'm more of a fan of James Madison, but I'm also a fan of the Anti-Federalists. Just thought I'd throw that out because... It's a rare opportunity for me to talk to somebody from the Cato Institute.
Okay, so to the question of fairness.
I didn't respond, yes.
Yeah.
A recent poll showed that an enormous majority of Americans think that opportunity has declined. And they also think that inequality is wrong. On the other hand, there is a partisan divide, and that's really where constructive debates need to happen. Democrats think that more should be done. Government should do more to combat inequality. Some Republicans think that way, too. I was hoping that the Republican candidates for president would discuss inequality more, but they're not. There's a wonderful book called The Undeserving Rich, which I refer to in my book. And the author argues that Americans, and this goes to right what Thea was saying, Americans resent the undeserving rich, and I can define that for you later, but they resent the undeserving rich when they see opportunity being blocked. And that's going on in this country right now. There are millions of Americans who see what politicians are rightly call a rigged system, and they believe that opportunity is being blocked. And in terms of social mobility in this country, it has become less than most of our peer countries. So that's my response.
Well, here's a question for Thea. Then I was asking Ron about the capital gains tax just before the break. So I wanted to address that with you for a moment. So some people will look at that suspiciously and say, well, I don't see how that's benefiting me anymore. The so-called job creators, that's a full phrase now, so-called job creators. I mean, indeed, there are job creators in the United States. But people have become increasingly suspicious of that, I think in part because the jobs aren't so hot. You know, the wages have not grown commensurate with the way wealth has grown. I think that's the problem more and more Americans have with that system.
Well, again, I think that there are a lot of concepts in there. So taking specifically the capital gains tax, I believe Ron had said, you know, before the break that Warren Buffett had said he hadn't heard of anybody who didn't invest because of, you know, capital gains tax. You know, I question that because who are Warren Buffett's friends? They're probably, you know, very wealthy like he is. But if you're looking at the smaller scale entrepreneur who's taking a look at, you know, starting a business which could ultimately employ not hundreds of people or thousands of people, but maybe five people, that is going to matter. And some of these people who are deterred, we don't know if they're deterred. And what you're looking at is, I think that, you know, Buffett also has said something along the lines of, you know, his secretary pays tax at a higher rate than he does. And what he's talking about is he's comparing income tax with capital gains tax. And that really is not a comparison that is worth making because these are two very different things. Sometimes it looks functionally the same because there are people who make their money through the appreciation of the stock in their own company, and that's kind of where they make the bulk of their money. It looks like income, but it's not. It's a value from their company. They have a company. They have built the company. It's increasing in value. The reason that it's increasing in value is that the thing that the company does is valuable to society. So people are paying the company for it. It increases in value, and the executive is able, or the stockholders are able to benefit from what they've provided to society. So they get, you know, a piece of that benefit in profits, and we tax that as capital gains. The workers who are hired to work for the company receive a salary or wages, and they are taxed at the income tax rates. But the difference in this is that the person who is building a company who is starting a company is taking a great risk because they don't know how well the company is going to do. It might fail. You know, I myself and my husband started a small company, and we took a great risk, and we took, you know, a substantial cut in income while we were building that company. And that's something where we could have gone off and earned a steady salary that we could depend on, that we knew how much we were going to make, but we didn't. We took a risk instead. And that's what we want people to do, because we want people who have ideas and who have something to contribute, because the idea is that if you have a product that people want, they value it at a greater amount than what they're actually paying you, right? Because they wouldn't pay the money to you if it wasn't worth having the thing over the money. So ultimately, everybody's better off. So we give preferential tax treatment to encourage people to do that.
Okay. But then you look at charts that show the concentration of wealth, the upper precincts of wealth in this country, the 1%, the 0.1%, and the amount of wealth that's there. People look at that, Thayer, and they say, well, something's wrong. This system does look like it's rigged to indeed make the rich be far richer than the rest of us. We can't possibly catch up because they, have so much capital to play with, and the tax rate is, historically speaking, so relatively low.
Well, there are a couple of things there as well. One of them is, if we're talking about inequality, we're not talking about absolute wealth. So you do have to look at, do people actually have, are they in a better position materially than they were before? And I think that over time, everybody's access to cheap, nutritious food, quality shelter has increased. The other thing is, I think that we tend to look back to this golden age of the 50s and 60s when we had, a very robust middle class. There are great jobs available for men with just a high school education. But what we're not looking at is what the global economy was at that time. That was just after World War II, so European infrastructure had been, in a lot of places, demolished. Asia was not the competitor that it is today. And so if you look globally, there are a lot of areas where we have a thriving middle class that we haven't in the past. And a lot of that is due to actually outsource, a lot of it is at the expense of certain American workers because mm-hmm. we've outsourced certain jobs. That's not to say, so maybe what we should be looking at is how to retrain those workers to bring them back into the workforce at capacity where they're contributing to the greatest extent of their abilities. But that's where we have a lot of the work is flowing elsewhere around the world, and then the profits do come back to the United States. We just have a much more global economy than we had in the past. I'm not sure that we can return to the manufacturing sector we had in the 50s and 60s. It's just a totally different world.
Right. Ronald Formosano. Ron, go right ahead.
Don't know where to begin. Let's begin with all those free trade deals that have protected skilled, educated professional workers and have outsourced the jobs of workers at the bottom. Let's start with that. And by the way, that's a way to interfere with the free market, which I believe Cato and other conservative think tanks advocate. The wage productivity gap has developed in the last 20, 30 years. Workers in the United States are more productive and their wages have flowed to the top. And the ridiculous multiple times that of the salaries of CEOs have gotten to the point where they are 400 times the average worker, but I'm not even looking at Iger's of Disney. One calculation had him 2,200 times more than the average worker at Disney. Wealth is flowing to the top, and it's a rigged system. Transfer of risk. I admire anybody who starts an independent business. You are taking a great risk. But what's going on with the kinds of businesses that many people try to move up into the middle class, for example, McDonald's and other franchises? Well, the franchising has shifted all the risk to the person who starts the franchise. Retirement risk is now being transferred to the employee. Defined benefit pensions are becoming rare, but the CEOs have millions in their retirement accounts. There's been a freezing of the defined benefit plans that exist, and so now they're having workers rely more on IRAs, 401s, and so there's this great. Jacob Hacker, the political scientist, has written a wonderful book about this called The Great Risk Shift. And Ellen Schultz, a Wall Street financial reporter, has written a great book about the great retirement heist. So, yeah, risk is being transferred, all right, but it's being transferred to people at the bottom and people aspiring to get into the middle class. There are so many things that Thea touched upon, those are the ones that I can remember right now to respond to.
Thea, I have one more question for you. I just want to address this with you. The premise of Ron Fomisano's book, Plutocracy in America. I mean, I guess if you're a libertarian, I'm wondering what the libertarian view is on this, that if wealth becomes so concentrated and we have such disparity, can you see how that might undermine democracy? That if the political system, for instance, is just drenched in money, it becomes harder for people at the bottom to have a voice in this democracy. The democracy, the power becomes more concentrated along with the money. Can you see that happening? Do you see a danger ahead in that?
I do. I'm not sure if Ron meant to lump Cato in with the conservative think tanks, but just to be clear, we're not conservative. We are libertarian. I think one thing I'm entirely opposed to what we would call crony capitalism. I think that, you know, you get a lot of times the more the wealthier companies tend to get regulation that will benefit them and prevent new entrants into the market, provide a stumbling block for smaller, more entrepreneurial companies. I think that that is really problematic. To my mind, the solution is to have fewer things that are under government jurisdiction. I think that if we're going to have power, does tend to concentrate with wealth. I think if you look throughout societies, throughout history, where there's a concentration of wealth, there's also a concentration of power. So instead of giving more power to the government, which tends to be, just throughout history, it's human nature, tends to be more controlled by the wealthy, why don't we reduce the number of things that the government can control? And then that reduces the influence that concentrated wealth has.
Thea, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Thea Brooke Knight from the Cato Institute, and she writes commentary for Cato at Liberty, and you can find her on the Cato website. In her blog posts at cato.org, Cato. Thank you very much, Brooke. Thea.
Thank you very much.
Thea Brooke
Knight. Thank you to Ron.
Yes. And we'll come back and have some more conversation with Ronald Fomisano about his book, Plutocracy in America, just published by Johns Hopkins University Press. We've got a couple of phone lines open if you want to get in. When we get back, we'll go to Frank and Jeff, 410-662-8780, if you have a comment or question for our guests. And welcome back to our conversation with Ronald Fomisano and his book, Plutocracy in America. Let's take a couple of calls. Jeff in Westminster, Maryland, for our guest, Ron Fomisano. Go right ahead, Jeff.
Thank you so much. This is great. Thank you so much. Mr. Fomisano, is it?
It's Fomisano, Fomisano, Ron Fomisano.
Great for the spelling. We can find books more easily that way. So I don't know, maybe it's Dr. Fomisano, but in any case, my question has to do with whether or not we actually do live in even a representative democracy, especially remembering the 2000 election when five people appointed a president who was actually received a lower popular vote than the Al Gore who was running. But also concerning how laws are written, which is often not even by the people we elect, maybe by K Street American Legislative Exchange Council might be discussed, which writes a lot of law that is accepted whole in the form that they write it by states across the country, mm-hmm. and often supportive to the plutocracy. If you could mention that. And lastly, I was so grateful to the doctor for mentioning that Cato Institute was founded by, and are they supported annually by big money from Koch brothers, and why?
No longer.
Oh. Yeah, that's the point Ron made.
So they don't receive any funding anymore from Cato?
No.
I mean from Koch
brothers? Not from the Kochs.
No funding from the Kochs. Well, yeah. So they could be introduced at least in full disclosure each time they are introduced as founded by the Koch brothers. I think that would be something that full disclosure kind of demands, and nobody ever says. Libertarian is not descriptive to most people.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that's what they call themselves. That's how they identify, and they're widely identified as that, to distinguish them just from being a conservative think tank more on the libertarian side. But anyway, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and other organizations, Ron, that receive funding from the Koch brothers,
yes,
and big money. And then we have, you know, we haven't even mentioned the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court. All of that, I suppose, supports your argument about being on the edge, the tipping point of a plutocracy.
Yeah, I was about to mention that. And great question, by the way, great comment. I want to apologize to Thea, if she's still listening, for saying conservative instead of libertarian. In fact, there's some aspects of the Cato Institute and their libertarianism that I actually admire, although I'm really sort of on the other side of the political spectrum. The Democracy Index of The Economist in 2012 put the United States at 21st among its peer countries, primarily because of polarization and paralysis in our government. And Citizens United and McCutcheon have made our electoral system awash in money. And they allowed some 1,500 to 2,000 very wealthy individuals to increase what they give in to campaigns, to political action committees, to candidates. The fact that our elected officials already ignore the non-wealthy and the middle class is very well established. That's been the subject of some excellent books and studies by political scientists. They already ignore when the interests of the middle class fit with what elites want. Then there tends to be some congruence. There's a book about lobbyists in Washington. It's called So Damn Much Money. That's the other way that our system is awash in money. I wanted to say to Thea, I agree with her about crony capitalism, but given the hundreds and thousands of lobbyists working all the time to make sure that they get special breaks for the interests, the corporations that they're representing, it's very difficult to deal with crony capitalism. There's one really interesting study I mentioned in my book of very wealthy people in Chicago and the 1% and their interaction with government. A goodly number of those people can call their senator directly. I wonder if the caller can call his senator directly. Yeah. I wonder if you can, Dan.
Yeah.
A goodly number of them can call the FEA. They can call somebody in the EPA, write directly. The congressman, boy, no problem. They can get right to them. Yeah. How many of us have that advantage? Who do our elected officials listen to? Well, you know, I call them the affluent, voting for the affluent in the great majority of cases. As you pointed out very early, not always, but in general, they are the affluent voting for the $174,000 a year. And then one needs to look at the way they exploit the system to get their relatives, wives on the payroll of their offices and their campaign staffs, and then their fundraising junkets and boy, do they want to live the high life like the 1%. This is many of them, not all of them, many of them.
Here's another call for Ron Formosano. This is Michael in Baltimore. Michael, go right ahead. Hi. Michael, are you there?
Yes.
What's going on, Michael?
I'm on an industrial site. I need to get to someplace quiet.
Okay.
Okay, I'm someplace quiet.
We're ready for you now. Please be brief, too.
Good. Here's the question. And the question and comment I'm interested in is that, you know, we have a Federalist type of government. The Federalists won. And now it's kind of like there's all these issues arising. And it's my point of view. I was actually discussing this with my son last night over dinner. And it's like we have a gerrymandered existence. And it's not, we need to know that the models for our government, it's not, it's the House of Lords and the House of Commons, the commoners and the lords. And in the United States, we have the House of Representatives, which would equate to the House of Commoners, and the Senate, which is the House of Lords. And our entire system is set up to put the power at the top. And no matter what we do messing around on the fringes, we have a flaw. And the flaw is that to the spoils of war, the winner wins and the loser loses. Well, and I think that America is at the point where we need a more of a representational government where we have a government built up of a lot of different factions. I think would spread the wealth of ideas, and I want to get your comment on that.
Well, I mean, we still vote. we still have a vote. You may feel like the system is rigged or gerrymandered, as you say, because there's so much money influencing elections, right? Go ahead. I'll let Ron Formosano. I mean, we still vote.
Well, the word gerrymander is relevant because Democrats practiced it 30 years ago, and Republicans have become very good at it now, creating safe districts so that the rate of incumbents being reelected every year makes congressional elections something of a joke. I mean, what is your reaction? This is a rhetorical question. What do people think when they hear, well, we've got 45 seats in play this year. Wow. 45 seats are competitive, and the rest of them are not. And that's usually because somebody's retired or because they haven't gotten around to redrawing the
map,
the district lines. I would say to your caller, we just have to keep fighting back. You know, so much of it right now is a rear guard action. You had all these states after 2010 that started passing all these voter ID laws. We need to fight back against those kinds of things that are targeting specifically vulnerable people in our society and making it difficult for them to vote. Registration in this country is very difficult, and it shouldn't be in many. I live in a state where the polls close at 6 o'clock. My doctor never votes because he works until 6 o'clock.
That's in Kentucky.
Yeah, in Kentucky. Yeah. Shouldn't he be allowed to vote? Yeah. I think he should be allowed to vote. He's a nice guy, and he's a heck of a good doctor.
Ron, listen, we have to go. Okay. I enjoyed this time with you. I appreciate you making it for us.
Oh, I thank you, Dan, for inviting me, and you've asked some excellent questions. Thanks. And, you know, we've just scratched the surface.
Yeah. Well, if they want to scratch a little deeper, Ron Formosano's book is Plutocracy in America: How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. Ron Formosano, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Kentucky. The book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everybody. I hope you have a great afternoon. See you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Beatrix Lockwood, Adam Dronberg, and Aaron Morenzi. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.